Mr. Evans, Reel 5.
Right.
Did you have much contact with the local civilian population?
Right. That's a good question. We had only been there for a few days, and we found the local girls, the village girls, were flocking round the gates. It was quite exciting for them to have these young soldiers arrived at townspeople compared to their little village life, and so they were quite excited. And also, in the local village, there were evacuees, the Israel ladies from Hull, who had been evacuated with their families into the local villages. And to my surprise, some of the older members of the crew struck up a relationship almost instantly with these evacuees, and it was almost like a second marriage. And I was rather shocked, because some of the members of the detachment were my father's age and were long married men in Stockton, and it shocked me to think that within a couple of weeks they could start up a relationship, which they did. So that was a lesson I learned from life.
And did you get to visit the local village pubs or the village homes?
Well, very rarely, because we weren't allowed out of the site. I think we had 12-hour passes about every 10 days, and we normally then went into Morton, which was 5 miles away. And we went to the pictures and had fish and chips at the Silver Grid, and it was time to come home. And the last bus, I think, was about 7:45, otherwise you walked. So very often we did walk, so we stayed a bit longer. That was our time out. I was at Westover Grange for 1 year, and during that time we provided huts for us, and so the conditions were much improved in that respect. But it was a fairly harsh life, and my first leave was after Christmas, so I'd been 4 months before I got my first trip back to Stockton, and I thought things would be equally harsh at home with wartime conditions. And I got quite a shock, because the place was booming and all the cinemas were full, the dance halls were booming, and everybody seemed to be having quite a nice time, which surprised me, because we went back to our rather primitive existence. The composition of the detachment began to change. One time they came around asking for volunteers to do mine laying in front of the Maginot Line, and two of the chaps were so fed up with our existence that they volunteered for anything to get away from that routine. So that was the first break in our detachment. And then we received two militiamen, and they were lads from the West Country, and they were Jodhpurs, had been in a cavalry regiment at Oswestry Street, and spoke with West Country accents. And one was called Ruckstraw, you know, it's not a northeastern surname, and one was called Tuffy Brooks. So they were the first two outsiders to come in. And then as time went on, we received some what they called immatures, and these were 17-year-old lads from the infantry regiments who were not allowed to be sent overseas. So they came to us. So it was another dilution. And then in due course, the first of the conscripts, what they call the first intake, came in, and then the second intake, and then the third intake. So gradually the very localised composition of the DLI was diluted. Then again, due to expansion, they were forming new regiments in other parts of the country, and they were taking certain of our men away and form what they called a cadre, a basis for this that the new regiment was based on. So things changed over that year. Another thing was that after a few months we stopped being DLI and we became Royal Artillery. And the chief consequences of that to us were that corporals were called bombardiers, which sounded very important. And the question, did we wear lanyards or not? Because we gathered that lanyards were what artillerymen used when they fired the guns. And we didn't know whether we were justified in wearing them, because we were searchlights. At the same time, they looked quite attractive on a uniform. So we went down to Malton to the military shop and we bought lanyards and we wore them.
Was there a spell between DLI and Royal Artillery where you were Royal Engineers?
No. No, straight into. And the company, 411 Company, became 411 Battery. So that was...
How did you get on? I mean, you're a small group living cheek to jowl, almost.
Yes, yes.
How did you get on with the rest of the... Or how did they get on with each other?
Well, you had to get on, but living in close proximity, there were personality clashes, but at the same time, you had to get on with it. People who tried to dodge their duties and their fatigues, etc., and other people who got stuck in. It's the same with any group of people.
What rank was the searchlight commander?
Well, normally a corporal, occasionally a lance corporal, and so normally you would find a full corporal would be detaching commander and a lance corporal would be the number six. He was looked upon as the deputy commander.
Do you recall your early searchlight commanders or commander?
Oh yes, the first corporal was called him Corporal Moody, Pom Moody. I don't know why they called him Pom, but he was all right, and he was with us for a number of months, and I was replaced by another corporal, Corporal Hardy, and he was all right. In fact, what I found was that I was at West Ogres for 1 year, and by the end of the year, we'd become a close unit. We knew each other well, and the idea of moving to another unit where they'd be all strangers was quite daunting. But I found out in due course during the war that wherever you went, you met a group of men who were roughly the same as the ones you had left, and you soon fitted in, and it didn't matter, wherever you went.
Can we look briefly, before we move on, to the officers within the unit? You had a corporal as a searchlight.
Yes.
There'd be an officer above him, obviously. What did they command a number of searchlights?
Yes. Of the 24 searchlights, there were four sections. Each section had a headquarters, and at headquarters there was a lieutenant, and he was responsible for those six. There was also a section sergeant who used to come round every day, bring down the rations, orders for the day, etc., and perhaps take anybody back that was being moved or going on leave or dental parade or whatever. Yeah.
I know we probably have mentioned the officers, or some of the officers, in an earlier tape, but were they okay? Were they good men? Did they get on pretty well? Treat you properly?
Oh, yes. We didn't have a lot to do with them because they weren't on site with us. But they were local men because, for example, Captain Fletcher was a dentist in Bishopton Lane, and the Colonel Ray was from Ray's Brass Foundry, and there was Captain Carter, I think he was from Head Wrightson's. They were all local men. And
presumably the lieutenants would have the job of inspecting the various searchlights.
Yes.
Seeing everything was being...
They used to come round once a day, have a word with the detaching commander, but then you'd sometimes get a visit from a headquarters man. Remember, there's one Captain Carter who was a bit of a stern, bit of a tyrant. He was all right, really, but a bit of a disciplinarian, and he would come round occasionally, and you got to know about him. He had two key points. He used to always check the grease traps, that is the sort of waste coming from the cook house, and the grease traps had to be cleaned and removed and new ones put down. so that this grease didn't accumulate. So he always checked the grease tops. And sauce bottle tops, he always used to check the top of the tomato sauce bottle. See, it wasn't encrusted, you see, with the dried up sauce. Of course, the cook's got to know this, and so any old dirty floor cloth that wiped round the sauce bottle top, and Captain Carter's quite happy, although we probably did more harm than good.
You would presumably get the typical army food.
Yes, that was another thing. I came from what you might call a modern estate and a respectable sort of home, and a lot of the chaps came from what we used to call the slum areas of Stockton, now largely demolished, streets and streets of terrace houses. And every day we'd get a ration wagon would come up and it would give us tins of salmon and beans and big tins of jam, bread, dried fruit, etc., and flour, the ingredients for making suet duffs. And I was always sort of amazed at the people are giving us all this food for nothing, you know. But I found that the lads who came from what we call the slum districts, they were very critical, and they would not eat margarine, only butter. And they wouldn't eat pink salmon, only red salmon. They were obviously used to a high standard of living, whereas I was glad for anything, you know. Just think, fancy, they're sending us all this up. So that's it. That's how the rations were.
Did you get any additions to your food in the sense that was there a canteen, or did any canteens visit the sites?
No, not at that stage. No, that was the early days. The first year we didn't get anything like that. But we had plenty to eat, and we had healthy appetites because we were out in the open air so much and for so long that we got very, very hungry because we did a lot of sandbagging and digging, and it was amazing the amount of work you had to do. And so a lot of us began to put weight on as well.
You mentioned the severe winter. How did you keep warm? We were still intense during that winter.
Well, just for a few weeks, and before the winter really set in, we'd got the huts, and in the hut we had a coke stove, and once we got it going, it would be quite nice. Everybody used to get round this. Those that weren't on guard, waited to go on guard, would get round. And that kept the cold at bay.
Were you still sleeping on palliasses in the huts?
No. By that time, some of the men bought collapsible camp beds. Rather flimsy things they were, but you could buy them. And some men made their own. They got lumps of wood and timber they found and knocked up an old bed with sacking, and that was it. And it was only well into the first year that we began to get beds provided, so that was
and cleaning was all right. Keeping the huts clean would be another duty,
another job. We had to keep the sleeping huts clean, the recreation hut clean. When Colonel Ray told us that we had to make ourselves as comfortable as we could for 5 years, we bought the piano from the farm. I remember we had to manhandle it across this field and put it in the recreation hut. And one of the lads, Vernon Hindmarsh, who had been brought up in Stockton Town Hall, was a talented musician, and he formed a little group. So we had he played the piano, we had a chap who played a little drum kit, one chap was a trumpet player, Scotty, and he brought his trumpet, and I had a little banjo-lele, so we had a little band going just amongst ourselves. So you made your own entertainment, you see, no radios, so that was it. And at night we'd have a sing-song sometimes, those who weren't on duty, sing the old songs, a mixture of bawdy Victorian ballads, which are largely forgotten now, but were introduced to us by the regular soldiers who were still in and joined the territorials. So it was a mixture of obscene Victorian ballads and very sentimental songs like The Old Rugged Cross and Broken Hearted Clown. So the two extremes. So that was our entertainment.
Do you remember your first Christmas celebrations on the site?
Oh, I don't think there were any. The only thing is, I remember the detachment commander allowed about four of the men to go down to the village pub. And one of them, a lad called Ginger Coldclough, was a big lad, he was a blacksmith from ICI, only a young lad, and he got absolutely roaring drunk. And it was rather an alarming incident, that, but he came up from the generator tent and he had a rifle. And the air sentry that was on, a chap called Notman, tried to stop him, and he swung the rifle round, holding it by the barrel end, and he caught Notman on the forehead with this rifle butt and caused a nasty gash. And then he came into the hut, the sleeping hut, and he fixed bayonets, and he said, you're all spies, I'm going to charge you. And we were all huddled in a corner. It was very, very alarming. And he was a big, powerful lad, and he was going to charge at us with this bayonet. And as he came towards us, the detachment commander, that was Corporal Hardy, who'd also been out drinking, and was laid on his bed, more or less in a semi-drunken sleep, suddenly came awake and jumped on his back, this Ginger Coldclough, and that enabled a couple more of us to go and get him, and we managed to manhandle him and calm him down. And then he went to sleep, and when he came to next morning, he was docile and couldn't remember much about what had happened. So I wondered what the punishment would be for that. So he went down to headquarters, and he appeared before Colonel Ray, and his punishment was 7 days confined to barracks. That was kept confined at the headquarters, which was then Hutton's Ambo Hall, and he had to do jobs like scrubbing floors and carrying sacks of coke about. So it didn't seem too bad. But it could have been a very nasty incident. That was Christmas, that's what you asked me about.
And you did get a Christmas meal of some kind?
Oh no, just normal dinner. We used to have duff every day. It was just to get this mixture of flour and suet and make this suet pudding, which you used to wrap in a cloth, put in a dixie full of water, and boil it for a couple of hours. That was always quite nice. So we used to have one day jam duff, and then you'd have raisin duff, and then date duff, and whatever you had. Man, but when you're hungry, you eat it and enjoy it. So that was it.
You mentioned that the latrines originally were a hole dug in the far side of the field.
Yes.
Did they improve? Did they bring them? You
know? Oh, yes. Well, I think it was improved because the original latrine was tucked away under some trees at the far corner of the field. And you went up there, and there was a canvas screen round and a branch held up by a couple of trestles over this pit, and you could sit there and contemplate. And in these autumn nights, it was quite peaceful. The birds would be singing, and you were on your own, private. And at the end, everybody had to sprinkle some chloride of lime into the pit. That was a normal thing. When they got the huts, they also brought well, it was a latrine, but it was quite a complicated structure. But in one corner there was a bucket with a wooden lid on, you see, and that became the latrine, which had to be emptied every day. It wasn't quite as private and peaceful as the original basic latrine. And then when it got bitterly cold, the air centers used to be nearly frozen to death in the depths of that winter. And so they decided they could have a coke stove inside this latrine structure, like a brazier, and so that it couldn't be seen from the air. They put a corrugated sheeting over it, so the air sentry was allowed to come in and warm himself up every so often. Unfortunately, because it was enclosed, the fumes from the coke used to send him off to sleep, so they had to stop that. But we got through it all right that winter, and worse things happened in China.
And it was the same routine throughout the time you were there, and as you say, you didn't get much actual enemy activity that you were
engaged. No, it was what they call the phony war, wasn't it? And nothing happened until I went on a 48-hour leave, and I got to York Station, and the train came in from London, and there was a man leaning out of the window, and he was all unshaven and scruffy. He didn't look like a true British soldier at all. And I heard him talking to some people, and that's the first time I heard the word Dunkirk mentioned. So I didn't know what had happened, but obviously he had been to Dunkirk and he was being sent home on leave. So from that time on, there was the threat of invasion. And how we countered or prepared for it was this. At the crossroads near West Oak Grange Farm, we dug slit trenches so that in the case of parachutes, it's arriving and coming down one of the roads, you see, would be in the slit trenches, and hopefully, if we had any ammunition, would engage them. Also, the farmer had a loft, a granary, and I remember we put some big sacks of corn over which would lean and fire down with our rifles, once again, if we had any ammunition. Then there was a local home guard formed by the young farmers round about, and the idea was that if there was an invasion, they would come onto our site, and we had a vehicle, and they would get in this vehicle and drive away to wherever the action was. These farmers used to look a bit sort of amused at the whole thing, because they were more concerned with down-to-earth farming and reaping and sowing and mowing, etc., real life. The vehicle we got, it was an old Pantechnicon. It was a very, very old one. It must have been a 1918 vintage, and it had a metal H-shaped gearbox, and it was made of wood, a big vehicle, and on the side it said G. Harker Furniture Remover. Well, of course, at that time there was a famous film star called Gordon Harker, so we used to call it Gordon Harker, this vehicle. And as it came onto the site for the first time, one of the wheels fell off, so that was a good start. So that was another problem that the German troops would have had to encounter, Gordon Harker and the Farmers' Home Guard. Also, we had to stand to every morning and every night for 3/4 of an hour, so this was an additional chore we had to do, and we used to stand to, get into our Lewis gun pit, etc., and wait in case there was an airborne invasion, and of course it didn't happen.
What was the morale of people like when Dunkirk burst on them, that we had left the continent in defeat?
We felt fairly remote from it. We were fairly remote from our own unit. I mean, the fact that there were 400 men in 411 Battery, you only knew your own detachment. Maybe you come across members from another detachment when you went into headquarters on Bath Parade. You hardly knew the members of your own company. And the other sections, they were like a foreign detachment or a foreign unit altogether. You never met them. They were miles and miles away from you. Yes.
Bath Parade that you've just mentioned there, how did that work? Because they wouldn't clear the site of all of you, would you?
So many would have to go on Bath Parade.
And how often did that happen?
Well, once a week, officially, yeah. You sort of go down to... At that time, the headquarters had moved from this tented camp in Wellham Road to a country house called Hutton's Ambo Hall. And they had these showers there, which were so-so. Trickle of water, sometimes hot, sometimes cold. But that was it.
The long days, months, weeks of being there and not really getting the excitement of action, did you find it time hung on you, or it was boring and a little bit down-spirited?
It's hard to recollect now, but no, I think you got into the routine of life. We used to spend a lot of time cleaning our boots. When we weren't allowed off the site or anything, but we'd sit on the doorstep of the hut, and we took great pride in our boots, and we used to clean them and bone them. You know what boning is, with a toothbrush, and spit and polish. We spent hours and hours till we got them absolutely perfect, and the soles as well. Yeah.
Were there any changes coming in? The beginning it was very poor equipment. It's very basic equipment.
Oh yes, it was.
Were the changes coming in the first year or so that you were there?
No, not in the first year. Very little difference there. Towards the end of the first year, I was moved to section headquarters, and this was a place called Whittle on the Hill, and it's on the road between York and Scarborough, about 3 miles before you get to Moulton. And from Whittle on the Hill, you could survey right across the Vale of York. And my duty there was to be a telephone operator. And at that time, we were then provided with radio telephones. So we had contact with... I had a five-line switchboard, which put us in contact with headquarters. And we had these... telephone headsets, and we could talk to the different sites. Our site section was called Willie 2-1, Willie 2-2, because we were second section, you see. And so we used to ring the site every hour and contact them. We also used to inform them when to take post when there was an alarm and when to stand down. And my telephone equipment was in a very small hut, which was the officer's hut, and that was Lieutenant Bulmer. He was only 19, a very nice lad, and he was from the Bulmer shipping family of Middlesbrough. And I remember we had an awful time with earwigs. They were all over the place. At night, before you went to bed, you could see these earwigs crawling up the walls and falling off the rafters, and we used to have earwig hunts and kill as many as we could with newspapers. And we had to, some lads used to put cotton wool in their ears to stop these earwigs getting in. You'd cut a loaf of bread and you'd find earwigs had got right into the middle of them. They were all over the place. You had to stand your boots, your gum boots, upside down beside you, ready for take post, because if they were right way up, they'd be full of earwigs. There were millions of them.
And how did you overcome that? Did you just have to live with it? There was no way of...
Well, I remember the section sergeant, he was called Paddy Sorden. He was a rough diamond. He used to say, brute force never got nobody nowhere. That was his motto. And he decided we'd get rid of these earwigs. And we all moved out, and we slept outside in the open for 2 nights. And we put sulphur candles in the huts. And then at the end of the 2 days we came back, and the earwigs were still there.